Welcome in. Make yourself comfortable. We are so glad you're joining us today for this custom-tailored deep dive. We've got a really fascinating piece of modern theatrical history lined up for you.
We really do.
Yeah, it's one that serves as a total masterclass in
Yeah.
intellectual property, brand loyalty, and just, the sheer unpredictability of creative endeavors. It's a story that proves even the most globally recognized, beloved narratives can have some very bumpy second acts.
Right. It's a perfect case study in that tension between creation and consumption. Today, we are looking at the comprehensive encyclopedia entry for the 2010 musical Love Never Dies.
Which is such a wild ride.
It is. Our mission for this deep dive is to explore the chaotic creation, the drastic narrative pivots, and the highly polarized reception of Andrew Lloyd Webber's official sequel to The Phantom of the Opera.
The official sequel.
Exactly. And ultimately, we want to extract the underlying lessons this whole saga holds about the risks of altering a massive cultural property.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because, I mean, think about the scale of the Phantom of the Opera. We are talking about one of the most successful entertainment properties of all
A
time.
complete juggernaut.
Right, a cultural juggernaut that has generated billions of dollars and captivated millions of people. So to go back into that established universe and just decide to alter the trajectory of those characters, that is a massive swing. It requires a lot of confidence.
It requires a fundamental belief that the creator still owns the narrative. What we are really examining today is the inevitable clash between an artist's desire to evolve their characters, to push them into uncomfortable new territories, and an audience's fierce protective ownership over the original story.
Yeah, fans get very protective.
They do. When a piece of art becomes universally beloved, the audience internalizes it. They feel like the lore belongs to them. So changing those established facts is incredibly dangerous territory for any brand.
And we're going to see just how complicated that territory gets, because the road to getting this sequel on a stage was exceptionally long. Like, Lloyd Webber actually started planning this follow-up back in 1990.
Just 4 years after the original opened in London.
Exactly. And the initial concept, which was born from a conversation with the original designer, Maria Bjornsson, was to have the Phantom relocate from the subterranean catacombs of Paris and move into Manhattan's very first penthouse.
Which presents a striking visual
Oh,
contrast.
totally.
You're taking a character defined by the shadows and literal underground isolation and elevating him to the absolute top of the world in a bustling, modern American metropolis. It signals a complete tonal shift from the gothic romance of the original.
Yeah, but that penthouse idea eventually faded because Lloyd Webber watched the television documentary about the Coney Island Fairground.
Right, the aesthetic drew him in.
It did. That specific aesthetic sparked something for him, and Coney Island became the new setting. But finalizing a story to match that setting took years of trial and error.
The creative process took many winding turns. Lloyd Webber initially collaborated with the acclaimed author Frederick Forsyth.
Which is an interesting pairing.
It was. They worked on generating a storyline, but that partnership eventually dissolved because Lloyd Webber felt the specific ideas they were developing wouldn't translate effectively to a stage musical format.
But Forsythe didn't just throw the ideas away, right?
No, he retained the concepts they had outlined and actually published them in 1999 as a novel titled The Phantom of Manhattan.
So a version of the sequel was just out there in the world as a book, just not on a stage.
Yes, for years. It wasn't until 2007 that the theatrical version finally gained real traction. Lloyd Webber brought in Ben Elton, a previous collaborator, to help shape a workable synopsis.
And Elton's approach deliberately focused on the original core characters rather than introducing a massive ensemble of new ones.
Right. That specific treatment is what finally got the green light. They also brought in Glenn Slater as the lyricist.
Oh, and I love this detail. Slater later admitted his immediate unguarded reaction was that a sequel to Phantom sounded like a terrible idea.
That kind of internal skepticism highlights the inherent risk we are discussing. Even the people hired to build the project recognize the danger of tampering with such a sacred piece of intellectual
It's a
property.
huge gamble.
And that danger becomes very apparent when you look at how the creative team handled the core chronology of the brand.
Oh man, let's talk about that timeline. Because Lloyd Webber decided to set Love Never Dies in 1907. He explicitly stated in promotional materials that this was meant to be roughly 10 years after the end of the original Phantom.
What's fascinating here is the casual approach to basic chronological continuity.
Very casual.
Because the events of the original, The Phantom of the Opera, actually took place in 1881.
Right.
Therefore, 10 years later would be 1891, not 1907.
The math is not mathing.
It really isn't. This timeline discrepancy signals a major departure from strict literal continuity. It's an early indicator that the creators were prioritizing the new aesthetic and narrative they wanted to construct over the established objective facts of the original property.
And when brands rewrite their own history like that, core consumers notice immediately. But playing fast and loose with the timeline was nothing compared to the chaos of the actual writing process.
Oh, this is the best part.
It is. The sequel faced a catastrophic delay that had absolutely nothing to do with creative blocks and everything to do with a household pet.
Yes.
I want you, listening to this, to imagine losing your most important project, the one you spent years conceptualizing. The delay wasn't caused by a producer or a legal dispute. It was caused by a kitten.
A very specific, very destructive kitten.
Lloyd Webber had a 6-month-old, rare-breed Turkish van kitten named Otto.
Little Otto.
Otto somehow managed to climb onto Lloyd Webber's digital piano and completely deleted the score. Everything he had composed for the sequel up to that point vanished.
Yeah.
It's gone. Lloyd Webber had to sit down and reconstruct the entire musical score from memory and scratch. It is a wildly relatable moment for anyone who has ever forgotten to save a document, but the stakes here were a multi-million-dollar theatrical production.
It adds a layer of absurd behind-the-scenes mythology to the production, but honestly, the drama surrounding the creation of the music pales in comparison to the narrative shocks waiting for the audience on stage.
So true. Let's step into the world of the show. Welcome to Phantasma, an amusement park on Coney Island. This is where the Phantom, who is now operating under the mysterious pseudonym Mr. Y, has built his new empire.
Mr. Y?
Yep. He lives in a dark tower above the park, surrounded by freak show performers with names like Miss Fleck, Dr. Gangle, and Mr. Squelch. It is a complete Coney Island fever dream.
We have moved entirely away from the classical elegance of the Palais Garnier in Paris. The aesthetic is now vaudeville, burlesque, and the macabre spectacle of a turn-of-the-century circus.
It's jarring.
It is a jarring environmental shift that reflects the internal shifts of the characters themselves.
Here's where it gets really interesting, and arguably where the core of the controversy lies. The characters we know from the first musical are fundamentally altered.
Completely different people in some ways.
Let's start with Christine Daae. She arrives in New York with her family to make her American debut. She believes she has been hired by Oscar Hammerstein, completely unaware that Mr. Y is actually the Phantom orchestrating her arrival.
She is positioned as somewhat naive to the machinations around her, at least in the opening act. She's essentially a pawn in a much larger game being played by the men in her life.
But the most dramatic shifts involve her companions. Raoul, the romantic, dashing hero who saved Christine in the first musical, is now depicted as a bitter, resentful drunk who has gambled away the entire family fortune.
Quite the fall from grace.
Massive. And then there are Meg Geary and Madame Geary. In the original, Meg is Christine's sweet friend in the ballet chorus. In Love Never Dies, Meg is performing as an ooh-la-la burlesque girl.
And it gets darker.
Much darker. The plot reveals that she has been engaging in transactional sexual relationships with influential politicians in order to secure funding and permits for the Phantom's theme park.
Wow.
Meanwhile, Madame Giry, who is the stoic, mysterious ballet mistress, is now the Phantom's resentful, enabling business manager. These feel like massive character assassinations.
I might push back on the term assassination there.
Really? How so?
Well, from a writer's perspective, taking a flawed, prideful aristocrat like Raoul and exploring what happens when that aristocratic pride sours into a gambling addiction over a decade is a realistic, albeit very dark, character evolution.
Okay, I can see that.
And similarly, taking Meg's desire for the spotlight and Madame Giry's fierce loyalty and pushing them to tragic, desperate extremes under the pressure of maintaining a massive enterprise makes narrative sense.
Fair enough.
However, the issue is how this affects brand loyalty. You are taking beloved, aspirational figures and stripping away their nobility.
Exactly. And then the script drops the biggest twist of all. The narrative pivot that retroactively changes everything about the first musical.
The big reveal.
Christine and Raoul have a 10-year-old son named Gustav, who is a musical prodigy. And the show reveals that Gustav is actually the Phantom's child.
Yes. The script establishes that Christine and the Phantom shared a secret, passionate night together just prior to Christine's wedding to Raoul.
Oh, you're wild.
It radically reframes the emotional core of the original property. The original Phantom of the Opera was fundamentally about Christine ultimately choosing the light, safety, and normalcy of Raoul over the dark, obsessive genius of the Phantom.
Right, that was the whole point of the ending.
Exactly. But this sequel essentially dictates that she actually chose the Phantom, but he fled the next morning out of fear that she would reject his physical appearance in the daylight.
It demands a massive suspension of disbelief. You are asking fans to accept that the romantic resolution they have loved for decades was built on a lie.
Simon Phillips, who directed a later version of the show, pointed this out perfectly. He noted that if the audience does not buy the premise that Christine and the Phantom slept together, they will never come on board with the rest of the show.
It's the linchpin.
It is. It highlights the immense risk of altering a happily ever after. When a brand retroactively changes its own core mythology, it risks alienating the foundation of its consumer base.
And the climax of the show doubles down on that risk. Raoul and the Phantom make a literal high-stakes bet.
A terrible idea.
A really bad idea. If Christine sings the Phantom's new composition, the title song Love Never Dies, the Phantom wins her. If she refuses to sing, Raoul wins and the Phantom will pay off all his massive gambling debts.
And she sings.
She sings the song. The performance is beautiful. The crowd goes wild. Raoul accepts defeat and leaves. But then an unhinged and deeply jealous Meg kidnaps Gustav.
Things escalate very quickly.
They track her down to a desolate pier. Meg has a gun. She is screaming about how the Phantom never appreciated the profound sacrifices she made for him, and the gun accidentally discharges. Christine is shot.
It is a sweeping, melodramatic tragedy that completely dismantles the original survivors.
Christine dies right there in the Phantom's arms, but not before telling young Gustav that the Phantom is his biological father. The show ends with Gustav, the child, gently removing the Phantom's mask without any fear or revulsion, finally accepting him.
It is a conclusion that attempts to grant the Phantom the unconditional love and acceptance he was denied in the original narrative. But it achieves that resolution at the severe cost of Christine's life and Raoul's dignity.
All of this brings us to the premiere in March 2010, London's West End at the Adelphi Theater, starring Ramin Karimloo as the Phantom and Sierra Bagus as Christine.
Incredible talents.
Absolutely. And given the massive legacy of the original, expectations were astronomical. But the critical reaction was starkly divided.
The reviews were intensely polarized, reflecting the deeply controversial nature of the project. On one end of the spectrum, some critics were swept up by the sheer scale of the production.
Like Paul Taylor.
Yes, Paul Taylor of The Independent awarded it 5 stars. He specifically praised the visual splendor of the sets and noted that the orchestra poured forth Lloyd Webber's dark-hued, yearning melodies. For a segment of the audience, the immense theatricality and the soaring score were enough to justify the sequel.
But the other end of the spectrum was brutal. Ben Brantley of the New York Times gave it 0 stars.
0.
He vividly described the show as feeling as eager to be walloped as a clown in a carnival dunking booth and claimed it had a kick me sign pasted to its backside.
The language utilized by the detractors was exceptionally punitive. They weren't just critiquing a piece of theater. They were responding to what they perceived as a violation of a classic.
And the fans were just as vocal, if not more so. The internet provided a platform for immediate, organized backlash.
It got intense.
A Facebook group was quickly established called Love Should Die. Yeah, featuring a mission statement that explicitly called the show illogical, irrational, offensive, and a detriment to both the original novel and the musical. London theater bloggers even coined the nickname Paint Never Dries.
Paint Never Dries. That's rough.
It is. And that moniker was rapidly adopted by mainstream journalists covering the troubled production.
The controversy even extended to the score itself. The sweeping title song, Love Never Dies, drew immediate scrutiny.
Right, because it sounded familiar.
Critics and keen listeners pointed out that the core melody was identical to a song Lloyd Webber had previously written and released in 1998 called The Heart is Slow to Learn.
Recycling melodies.
Furthermore, musical analysts noted a striking similarity between the opening notes of the song and a composition by Charles Williams from 1949. Which later gained fame as the theme music for the 1960 Billy Wilder film, The Apartment.
So with a furious core fan base, highly aggressive negative reviews, and allegations of recycled music, the producers were forced into serious damage control.
They had to do something.
They took the extraordinary step of closing the London production for 4 days in November 2010 to implement substantial rewrites. They brought in Charles Hart, the lyricist from the original Phantom, to adjust the lyrics, and brought in a new director and choreographer to attempt to tighten the narrative pacing.
Despite those considerable efforts and financial investments, the damage to the show's reputation in London was largely irreversible. The original West End production closed in August 2011, having run for less than 18 months.
Which is shocking.
For a heavily publicized, massively funded sequel to a show that has run for decades, that lifespan is a profound commercial disappointment. A planned Broadway opening was indefinitely postponed as a result.
And the story could have ended there as a fascinating failure. But Love Never Dies actually found a resurrection down under.
Yes, the Australian production.
In 2011, an entirely revamped production opened in Melbourne, Australia. The producers brought in a completely new Australian creative team led by director Simon Phillips and designer Gabriella Talasova. They completely overhauled the visual identity of the show.
The Australian production smartly leaned into the surreal, nightmarish qualities of the Coney Island setting, rather than trying to ground it in traditional realism.
The physical elements were meticulously redesigned. They added these incredible, imposing set pieces. There was a giant Luna Park mouth that served as a gateway, and these massive, transparent obelisks that contained a gilded mermaid rotating inside them.
It sounds visually stunning.
It was a staggering visual upgrade that really embraced the oddity of the premise. And to an extent, it worked. This Australian version was generally much better received by local critics.
It actually became the definitive aesthetic template for the show moving forward.
Exactly. It was filmed for a worldwide DVD release, and this specific version is what was eventually replicated for international productions in Tokyo, Hamburg, and a major US tour.
However, a stunning new coat of paint does not alter the fundamental architecture of a house. Even with the breathtaking new visuals, the core narrative issues remained intact. When the US tour eventually launched, many American reviewers echoed the sentiments of the original London critics. They readily praised the spectacular sets, but they continued to refer to the story as mediocre fan fiction.
Mediocre fan fiction. That stings.
They specifically complained that Ben Elton's book made absolute nonsense of the original timeline and deeply compromised the established character motivations.
And this is where the academic analysis of the show provides incredible insight. Theater scholars have spent a lot of time dissecting why this specific sequel provoked such a visceral reaction.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the work of scholar David Chandler is highly relevant. He wrote a piece for the Oxford Handbook to the British musical specifically analyzing the Love Never Dies phenomenon.
What was his take?
He described the show as having a peculiar love-hate relationship to its original. Chandler suggests that the sequel almost acts out of Freudian displacement.
Can you break down what he means by Freudian displacement in this context?
Think of it like a rebellious teenager trying to establish their own identity by actively destroying the authority and rules of their parent.
Oh, that makes sense.
Chandler argues the sequel is actively trying to tear down the foundational truths of the original Phantom in order to justify its own existence.
By dismantling the characters?
Exactly. By so thoroughly dismantling the established characters, turning Raoul into an antagonist, making Christine unfaithful to her original definitive choice, the sequel demands that the audience reject the core premise of the first show in order to enjoy the second.
Because they can't both coexist.
Right. Because the original and the sequel are built on inherently contradictory imaginative premises, they cannot both be true in the minds of the fans.
So what does this all mean for you? Why dedicate a deep dive to a divisive theatrical sequel from 2010? Because it serves as a crucial lesson in intellectual property management and brand loyalty.
A very expensive lesson.
Whether you are launching a new product line, managing a corporate team through a transition, or even just telling a story, you have to understand exactly what your audience fundamentally values about your past work before you attempt to change it.
The creators assumed the audience loved the Phantom and Christine so implicitly that they would follow them anywhere.
Even into a dark, cynical Coney Island tragedy.
What they underestimated was how fiercely the audience protected the specific meaning and moral resolution of that original ending.
That is the core takeaway.
To summarize this incredible journey, it began with a deleted digital score, courtesy of a wandering kitten, evolved into a visually breathtaking but narratively polarizing spectacle, and ultimately divided critics, academics, and fans across the globe.
Quite the legacy.
While Love Never Dies did not replicate the universal record-breaking acclaim of its predecessor, it stands as a truly fascinating case study in artistic risk-taking. It demonstrates precisely what happens when a creator dares to touch the untouchable.
It is a wild ride from start to finish. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We hope you found a few valuable insights amidst the Coney Island chaos, and perhaps renewed appreciation for backing up your important files when pets are in the house.
Always back up your files.
But before you go, we want to leave you with a final lingering thought to explore on your own. Given the massive backlash against a human creator changing the lore of a beloved story, it makes you wonder about the future of AI in art and entertainment.
It's a great question.
If an algorithm had been fed the original Phantom and asked to generate a sequel based purely on what audiences empirically loved and felt safe with, would it have been a more commercially successful show? Or do we fundamentally need the messy, sometimes disastrous human audacity to take a massive swing and risk failure in order to push art forward?
Mm-hmm.
Think about it. See you next time.